Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Remember mortgage-backed securities and how toxic they were for the economy? Yeah, they were worse than we thought. What did the big banks know and when did they know it? Is the topic today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Manta, connecting millions of small business owners with new customers every day on the web at manta.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Comer Science and Education Foundation, dedicated to supporting innovative programs making a positive impact on the lives of individuals and communities.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on a Tuesday, everybody. It's the 21st of June today. And it occurred to me this morning, as we were trying to figure out what to put on the air this afternoon, that it has now been 4 years since we all became more familiar than we'd like with the phrase mortgage-backed securities. The summer of 2007 was when it all really started to go bad. And the news of the day this Tuesday tells us that the after effects are going to linger for a while. This morning, J.P. Morgan Chase agreed to pay more than $150 million to settle charges it sold bad mortgage bonds just as the crisis was starting. And the bank is still in the regulatory crosshairs, along with the Royal Bank of Scotland. Prosecutors say the pair tricked five wholesale credit unions into buying billions in risky mortgage packages, packages that put all five of them out of business. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has more.
Just how risky were the mortgages bundled in these investment bonds? Regulators at the National Credit Union Administration say in some cases the banks claimed the bonds were backed by mortgages with near zero delinquencies, but as soon as they were sold, default spiked so high the bonds became nearly worthless. At the Center for Media and Democracy, Mary Batari says these lawsuits are no surprise given a recent congressional inquiry into similar sales by Goldman Sachs.
It is a revelation when you see emails referring to these products that are being sold as trash. When they find someone to sell one of these products to, they call it pink elephants and unicorns. There is clearly a contempt for the people that they were selling these dangerous products to.
Batari sees a flurry of lawsuits ahead.
When you're dealing with J.P. Morgan Chase, the Royal Bank of Scotland, you're dealing with some of the major, major players in the industry. So you have to assume that this sort of double dealing was a widespread problem.
The New York Post reports the federal agency is planning suits against other banks, including Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, and Citigroup. Attorney Jacob Frankel is a former enforcement lawyer for the Securities and Exchange Commission. He says these lawsuits could be a roadmap for investors to file their own lawsuits.
Others will look closely at the nature of the claims the NCUA filed and determine whether those claims can in fact be a template for private causes of action by other institutions.
Frankel says many banks have already set aside cash to cover these potential damages, but he says they'll remain under this legal cloud for years to come. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Today, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration went well beyond smoking may be hazardous to your health and went straight to pictures of dead people. After years of increasing taxes and a declining smoking rate, health officials are trying to put the final coffin nail in the coffin. Marketplace's Jeff Horowitz reports.
Health advocates admit we've come a long way. 50 years ago, almost half of Americans smoked. A few years back, that number hit one in five and stopped, says Health and Human Services Deputy Secretary Bill Corr.
Despite the many health risks that are now well known, youth and adult smoking rates that had been dropping have stalled.
2 years ago, Congress gave the FDA broad powers to regulate tobacco. Surgeon General Regina Benjamin says these new full-color images are an attempt to get through to the 46 million Americans who still smoke.
We can get everyone to stop smoking, and that's what these graphic warnings are aimed to do.
When the images appear next year, the U.S. will fall into line with 41 other countries and World Health Organization guidelines. Dr. Adriana Blanco of the WHO says images are proven more likely than text to nudge people into quitting, partly by grossing out your friends and family.
Beyond the effect that it can have on the smoker himself, they also can impact in the people around. For young people, probably what impacts most is the lack of the fancy package.
But are the images gross enough? You can see the U.S. ones at marketplace.org. Other countries go farther. In Singapore and Australia, warnings on cigarette packs and anti-smoking TV ads give an up-close look at a mouth grotesquely disfigured by cancer.
Smoking causes all cancer. If it didn't, I wouldn't be needing chemotherapy.
Unlike the text warnings, which stayed unchanged, the FDA says it will use its new authority to ratchet up the images as needed. If you're not grossed out yet, hang in there. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
A couple of weeks ago, a new report about the healthcare overhaul got a lot of attention. Got it everywhere. Congress, the media, including us. McKinsey, the consulting firm, did a survey. They asked employers about their plans for 2014 when the healthcare law goes into effect. 30% of people who answered the questions said they would consider dropping employee healthcare benefits altogether. That's a very different outcome than almost every other report that's been done, as Marketplace's David Gurra explains.
No one knows with 100% certainty what'll happen in 2014.
Once the Affordable Care Act is in effect, we're going to be in new territory.
That's Henry Aaron, an economist at the Brookings Institution. He wonders whether employers will change their benefits or offer benefits at all when people can buy insurance at open exchanges.
Most of the studies to date have concluded that the vast majority of employers and virtually all large employers would continue to offer health insurance if they do so now.
So why is that? Allison Hoffman is a healthcare policy expert at UCLA Law School.
The dollars that they spend on health benefits for their employees are excludable from taxes.
In other words, it might be in their best interest to keep offering benefits, since
they're actually getting a large part of that subsidized, essentially, by not having to pay taxes on it.
Politicians questioned McKinsey's conclusion because it was so different from some other reports. Hoffman says there's a reason the McKinsey data stood out.
One thing that we have to keep in mind when we look at the results of something like this is that it's a survey, and they're asking people, what do you think you'll do in 2014?
McKinsey wouldn't talk with us, but in a statement, the company says it stands by the survey, that the report was based on opinion, not sophisticated economic models. Hoffman says that doesn't mean the report has no value.
It's an indicator that employers are thinking about these issues. Whether it plays out is a whole other story.
One that we won't know the ending to for a couple more years. In Washington, I'm David Gurra for Marketplace.
Wall Street's winning streak today stands at 4. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Over in London late last night, British police arrested a 19-year-old man in connection with some of the big computer hacking episodes of late. Specifically, they're trying to tie him and the group he is suspected of belonging to the hacking of Sony's PlayStation game console a month or so ago. Eleanor Mills covers cybersecurity for CNET. Eleanor, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
How much do we know about these two groups in the news today, Anonymous and Lulzsec, if I'm pronouncing that right?
Not a lot. Lulzsec, actually, they're hackers with, you know, a humorous bent. They say that they're doing it for the kicks. Anonymous, they've been around for a few years, and they previously had targeted, you know, Church of Scientology, and they also went after, late last year, they shut down temporarily some sites belonging to PayPal, Visa, and MasterCard after those financial organizations had stopped allowing WikiLeaks to get online contributions.
Is there a way to tell, basically, the financial damage that these hacks have caused?
It's really hard, and I'm sure that the website owners and companies are going to figure it out. When a site is down, their customers can't get to the site. There's also the money spent in having IT people, administrators, work 24/7 to try and get the website back up. So there are costs here, but it's always a question of how much.
Maybe it's just me, but it kind of seems like these two groups specifically are doing it because they can. You know, they're taking down the CIA website, they're taking down the Senate website, and basically doing it because they can get away with it.
You're definitely right. They are. With Lulzsec, they're doing a lot on Twitter, talking about, you know, their attacks, taunting their victims. So there is this sense of, you know, look what we've done. Aren't we great?
Are these guys really out for money? I mean, are they stealing money and transferring it to their own accounts when they break into, like, Sony and the PlayStation and all that?
No, not as far as we've seen. They're not really going after any kind of financial data or using that information to transfer money from accounts at all. This doesn't look like financial motivation at all.
Where does this get us then in the end?
I think that the message here is, if you have a website, if you're storing customer data, if you have anything sensitive, you have to take measures to protect your website, basically. I think a lot of websites and a lot of companies out there, I mean, big ones like Sony, they did not do enough to protect the data. A lot of these attacks are basic, you know, SQL injection, something that's pretty common and it's easy to protect against. And if the government and big companies are not doing it, then how secure should we feel?
What kind of injection was that? Sounded pretty technical to me.
Yes, it has to do with SQL databases, SQL. I know it's kind of techie, but it's a common type of attack on a website.
So it's not hard. What these guys are doing is not technically sophisticated?
Not really. And there are exploits and there's code out there widely available. You don't even have to write your own code.
Which makes this whole thing even scarier.
Exactly.
Eleanor Mills from CNET. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
So we were just talking about hacking and data theft, which can sometimes lead to identity theft. Now we're going to turn to a different kind of ID theft, one that doesn't get a whole lot of attention, one that victims sometimes don't find out about until years later, one that can be messy and expensive to fix and hazardous to your health. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
You expect your roommate to make off with your T-shirt, some food, maybe some old CDs. Scott Bennett's made off with his identity. Not long after, Bennett started hearing from hospitals and collection agencies demanding payment for treatment he'd never had. He's been trying to clear up the mess ever since.
Right here on top is a police report with fingerprints where I had to go locally to a police station to be fingerprinted.
Over the years, Bennett has spent untold hours trying to prove he was hundreds of miles away in his hometown of San Antonio when the fake Scott Bennett was being treated at hospitals in Nevada. It's not as easy as it sounds because health privacy laws protect the patient, even if the patient is an imposter.
In order to battle this, I need to know a lot of information about the actual charges, the doctors, the procedures, things that had actually taken place in order to fill out police reports. And that information cannot legally be given to me, so that makes it difficult also.
A recent survey conducted by the Poneman Institute for Experian, the credit reporting bureau, says medical identity theft costs victims around $20,000 in lost time, increased insurance premiums and legal fees. And the recession has made things worse. Larry Poneman is chairman of the Poneman Institute.
36% say a family member actually took and used their personal identification,
including insurance cards, to get medical care. That's up from last year. Medical identity theft costs providers and insurers around $2 billion a year. Once another patient masquerades as you, your medical records are inaccurate, and that can jeopardize your future treatment. Lynn Friedman heads the privacy practice at law firm Nixon Peabody.
This hospital or this doctor's office has treated this person as you. They've come in with an ailment, and now all of those medical records are under your name. And physicians are relying upon that medical information, which is false.
Victims have found their records showing everything from a different blood type to diseases and operations they've never had. They've also found their insurance benefits have been spent. The shift to electronic record keeping should make it somewhat easier to track medical identity theft, but it can only do so much. Pam Dixon is director of the World Privacy Forum.
Even the most extensive audit trail that I've personally ever seen in the field, it doesn't reach to the subcontractors, and any hospital system is going to have hundreds and hundreds of subcontractors to make things work.
Like back office billing operations and labs. Dixon says sometimes a staff member sells off patient information. Sometimes criminals buy a clinic to commit fraud, billing insurers for procedures that never took place. It's been 10 years and Scott Bennett is still haunted by his persistent thief. The situation is a strain on the whole family.
It's stressful. You know, some of the questions we've had is, what if this gentleman dies using my identification? What happens to my Social Security? What happens to life insurance?
His identity thief was at a hospital in Oregon recently. He says the bills should make their way to Texas in a few months. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
coming up.
Look at everything humane and everything social. You found it started in Egypt.
And that may, it turns out, include housing crises. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 109 points today, about 0.9%, 12,190 at the bell for the blue chips. The NASDAQ padded up 57 points, about 0.2%, 2687. The number, the S&P 500 gained 17 points, 1.3%, closed at 1295. Research in Motion helped take the NASDAQ higher today. The maker of the BlackBerry moved up more than 10%. Walgreens took off more than 4%. The largest U.S. drugstore chain said renewing its contract with pharmacy provider Express Scripts didn't really work out so well. Express Scripts, though, felt no ill effects, adding about 0.3% today. J.P. Morgan Chase advanced 1% after that payment we told you about. Best Buy rang up 2.3% today. The company authorized a new $5 billion stock repurchase program. The 10-year T-note nudged down. Again, the yield rose to 2.98%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Every 2 weeks, Freakonomics brings something special to Marketplace.
You sent me $5, man.
Wasn't that nice of me? Yeah.
That was nice. Should I open this?
If you dare, open it.
Oh, I hate you.
Join us as we unwrap little surprises. You'll be all the richer.
I kept the $5, by the way, from the lottery thing.
I've noticed.
All right.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Reputation.com, protecting online privacy by removing your personal data from the internet and stopping unwanted mail. Reputation.com. Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors mileage and safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. Learn more at Progressive.com. Marketplace Innovation Reporting is supported by the 2011 Jaguar XJ. Learn more at a local dealer or at jaguarusa.com. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its monthly report on mass layoffs. That's when 50 or more workers from one employer lose their jobs. The Senate Finance Committee holds a hearing on eliminating fraud in the unemployment insurance system. And do small businesses have access to the capital and credit they need? Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner addresses that at a House committee hearing. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. For most of us, the word cramming brings with it memories of late nights in the library getting ready for exams. The Federal Communications Commission, however, has no such memories. It says cramming has another meaning entirely, one that means consumers ought to read their phone bills more carefully. Sally Herships has more.
Jeff Kagan is a technology analyst. He says 20 years ago, phone bills were simple.
You got a bill, it said what you were charged for, and that was it.
Then, says Kagan, the FCC decided to make things clearer for consumers by having phone companies list every little charge on the bill. And we all know what that got us, a mile-long phone bill that's impossible to decode.
We are all paying for charges that we don't have to.
Millions of us, anyway. The practice is known as cramming, or sticking unauthorized charges into your phone bill, usually your landline bill. The FCC estimates that up to 20 million households have been stuck with cramming charges that can range from $1.99 to $19.99 a month. But Kagan says it's not only phone companies who are to blame.
Oh, no, no. It's telephone companies and it's many other companies who use the telephone companies as their billing partners.
Anything from long-distance services, voicemail, directory listings, even things like diet plans or yoga classes.
John Breo is with the National Consumers League. He says consumers need to scour their bills.
If you don't recognize the name of the company that's listed on the bill, if you don't know what the services were provided by the listed companies.
The FCC has proposed more than $11 million in fines against several telephone companies accused of cramming, and is considering new rules to make bills clearer and to fight mystery fees. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
The transitional military government in Egypt posted a poll on Facebook today. Why, you might reasonably ask? Seems they wanted to get a sense of relative popularity among the 20 presidential hopefuls in the election this fall. So this is definitely not Hosni Mubarak's Egypt anymore. The idea of an online survey, much less open elections, is beyond novel. But a lot of the problems the Mubarak government had are still going to be there waiting for whoever wins in the fall. And housing is one of the big ones. More than 18 million people live in Cairo right now. And if the government's going to get the economy going again, it's going to have to find places for all those people to live. And that's where our series Economy 4.0 comes in. How to make the global economy work better for more people. Today, our special correspondent David Brancaccio goes house hunting in Cairo. Nile
FM. Enough with the Nile already. The search for better ways for Egyptians to live means getting away from that river, where the bulk of this country's population is jammed cheek by jowl. Cairo's population density is double even Manhattan's, and real estate is so tight that one downtown slum sprawled into a rock quarry. For a rapidly growing population, one answer to the housing crisis is to develop land in the desert away from the river. I'm not the first to have noticed that this three-year-old outpost called Haram City looks like a village on Tatooine, Luke Skywalker's boyhood planet. Terracotta townhouses with domed roofs pretty much in the middle of nowhere. Unlike some of Cairo's famous new suburbs that cater to the rich, this place was designed to offer affordable housing within fully integrated townships, to quote the company that developed the project. Abdul Zahar Mohammed works for his family's company that does metal fabrication. He bought a place here 2 years ago for his wife Shireen and two kids. He's done great work with the interior, like building a loft. Yes, the computer is here. The inside of his house, Abdul Zahar loves. It's what's going on outside that's a problem for him. He says developers promised to build a community, but the picture sold turned out to be completely different from what he ended up with. Here's what happened. People from a slum in central Cairo now live in this particular section of Haram City. These residents were essentially dumped here by order of the government after a fatal rock slide in 2008 embarrassed the Mubarak regime into doing something about unplanned sprawl into shanty towns. These working-class people weren't given legal rights to their new housing, no leases or deeds. They were told, here's where you're living, get used to it. Abdul Zahar says he has nothing against the poor people who lost their houses. They are, he says, Egyptians just like him, and he wants them to live better. His problem is that he's not getting what he contracted for, a planned gated community with tidy shops arranged along a town square, as opposed to this. A jumble of tables piled with bread, cell phone cases, and cans of tuna. It's not what many of the working-class people had in mind either. Ahmed Abdel Tawab is a marble craftsman who says he got strong-armed out to Haram City as part of the government's anti-slum campaign. At first, he tried commuting to his old job, but it took 3 hours a day. Now he sells bags of cement and plaster here in his suburban purgatory. He says there's little work and no community here. He says, I love the ground on which I used to walk in old Cairo. The gatherings, my neighbors, there's no replacement for it. And there's the contradiction for a place promoted as the future of housing in Egypt. No one got what they wanted. The middle-class folks, like Abdul Zahar, had paid for serene, orderly living. The people from the shanty town need something they did have before, community, the ability to walk to friends and to work. Even the man who designed the buildings in Haram City admits the project's a disappointment. Mamdou Hamza is one of Egypt's most prominent urban planners and architects. The crucial thing going forward, Hamza says, is building not houses, but that word again, communities, self-contained ones, with the working, shopping, and sleeping all in the same enclave. Plus, friends and family need to shift as a group.
The neighborhoods are moving together.
The new Egyptian authorities pledged to build 1 million new units of affordable housing over the next 5 years. That's more than 500 new homes a day, which some critics say is a stretch. But Hamza envisions cooperative communities out in the hinterlands, farming, textiles, where living and jobs and friends are in one spot. Cooperative communities, he calls them, or...
It is a way something like the kibbutz in Israel.
I was about to ask you, it sounds a little like a kibbutz.
It is like a kibbutz. Cooperative societies in Egypt started 100 years ago. Maybe before it was in America or anywhere else. You look at everything humane and everything social, you find it started in Egypt.
Hamza spoke out about his vision recently and got 1,200 people from all walks of life volunteering to be pioneers in Egypt's western desert. Not another Haram city. This time it would be people moving there by choice as a community. In Cairo, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill, working with customers around the world to connect ideas to opportunities across food, agriculture, finance, and industry. Information at Cargill.com. By The Economist, covering news and ideas from around the world and the connections between them on newsstands, Android smartphones, and at The Economist Online. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today in which some rare political and economic truths are spoken. California, as you may have heard, is having some budget problems, really big budget problems. Legislators did finally pass a spending bill last week using some creative accounting. Governor Jerry Brown vetoed it, said it didn't fix things. And today the state controller agreed, using some new powers he has. He also said lawmakers can't get paid until they fix it for real. The budget they passed, he said, had elements that were, and this is a quote, miscalculated, miscounted, or just unfinished. Not quite voodoo economics, but still pretty good. All right, that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 109 points, 9-tenths of 1%. The NASDAQ padded up 57 points, about 2.1%. The S&P 500 gained 17 points, about 1.3%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid, and that is where you can turn for the latest in business and economic news early, early in the morning. Tomorrow, coming up next time, back here.
That's where you get the high salaries. That's where you get the incentives that ensure a high standard of living.
Where? You got to tell us where. Economy 4.0 on the road continues. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.